I'm going to talk to you about our system COBRA and more generally about the problem of concurrent ballot authorization in internet voting. This is joint work with Alex Essex, who unfortunately couldn't join us in no small part to newly born twins, and our former advisor, Urs Hengartner. So broadly, the topic is end-to-end verifiable voting. So these are voting systems where you have a provably correct tally, and we also protect the secrecy of everyone's ballots. We've used end-to-end systems in real-world elections as part of the team that did Scantegrity. We heard about, in Tacoma Park, we heard about Predavote's plans for Australia this morning. So we've deployed these systems. They're pretty polished at this point. So now researchers are starting to think about the transition to internet voting and whether we can take the strong properties that we can provide for in-person polling places with these types of techniques and use them for internet voting. So when we move or transition into internet voting, I would argue that there's basically three major problems. This isn't meant to be an exhaustive list, but these are three pretty big ones to start with. So we'll just go through them one by one. So the first one's coercion and vote selling. Online, obviously, there's no private polling booth. Anyone can be standing behind you, watching you how you vote. It could be someone who's paying you to vote a certain way. It could be someone who's trying to coerce you to vote a certain way. It seems my slides are advancing automatically, but that's all right. Maybe I'll unplug this. Sorry about this. Okay, untrustworthy platforms, another problem. So this isn't to say that when we do in-person voting that we don't have an untrustworthy platform problem. If you're using DREs or optical scanners, obviously we're not trusting those. The difference here is, well, there's lots of differences. There's differences of scale, the capabilities of everyday voters' computers. Malware's a big problem. The other, probably the critical feature is that the computer that you vote from is, you can audit that and make sure that your vote counts. And that counts for your own vote, but it's not the same computer that you're challenging that all voters are voting from. The intersection of these two systems that provide both of these properties, that's largely an open problem. I would argue it's one of the biggest open problems in cryptographic voting. I should note that for coercion resistance, you can weaken the definition of coercion resistance, and then you can get into this space. All of those systems have very strong definitions for coercion resistance. The final is denial of service attacks. So with denial of service attacks, this is arguably, you know, this is for the networking guys to figure out. I think that's reasonable. But what we need to be very careful about is that when we introduce these voting systems, if you can't attack it at the application layer. So for example, these coercion resistance voting systems, they allow the submissions of ballots. The ballots can be real or fake. And so you could flood the system with a whole bunch of fake ballots, and then there's a really computationally intensive processing that needs to be done on these ballots to filter out the fake ones. So that's a reliable way of, in the sense it's not denial of service from preventing a tally from forming, but it means that you're going to delay the amount of time that a tally takes. It takes the computer tally by a substantial amount. So what we're dealing with in this talk, our system COBRA, is meant to deal with the intersection of those two. Roughly, coercion resistance is the idea that, you know, if you're a voter, you can convince an adversary that you vote for Alice when in actuality you vote for Bob. The way the coercion resistant mechanism works is voters, this is in our scheme, they choose a password, and this password is registered during a registration process. This is a special password system. There's an ability to create fake passwords. So there's a simple rule, the rule's simple enough that a voter can do it in their head on the spot, and they can create fake or panic passwords. The idea is that if you want to sell a vote or if you're being coerced to vote a certain way, you just make up a fake password and vote with that. The system's going to accept it just like it was a real vote. So it doesn't behave any differently. But what we claim is that in the back end, we have a way that we can actually filter out all of the fake passwords, keep all the real passwords. It can be verifiable, so you know that the system's actually doing this. And furthermore, we don't reveal for any specific submission whether a particular ballot was fake or real. And then later at some time, if you do use one of these fake passwords, you're free at any time to submit your real password. and the system will accept it, and it won't be any different. I apologize again, my slides seem to be going ahead by themselves. Maybe there's someone in the other room or something with the remote, I'm not sure. So anyway, the focus of this talk is how we implement this function that's going to obliviously cancel it out. I guess the final point was that it's unlinkable. If you submit a real one, you can't look at two ballot submissions and you can't tell that they came from the same voter.
Is that unlikable or unlinkable?
It should be unlinkable, but I may have had a typo. Yeah, okay, well, we do like voters to submit real ballots. Denial of service is a problem for these coercion-resistant voting schemes. So the way that all the other schemes work in the literature is something like this. So voters come along, and essentially they're going to encrypt their password. So the box denotes an encryption. They're going to encrypt their vote. The encryption function is, you know, an additively homomorphic encryption function usually. So think AlgaMal, exponential AlgaMal, or Paillet. So they post these to the bulletin boards. The password could be real. Real means that it corresponds to something that was registered, which is some data structure called the roster. An asterisk denotes that it's a fake password. So anyway, the ballot authorization functions, they take all of the votes as a single batch, and when they come in, it filters out the ones with the star, so we claim that it's only going to keep the two votes that correspond to real votes. The big problem with this approach is that it has to work on all of the inputs as a batch. So that means you have to wait until the election's over before you can actually run this function. This function is expensive. It's at least linear in the number of submissions. Since people can submit fake values, you know, you could hammer away submitting fake values for a week, and then if sort of resources are equal on the EA side, it could maybe take them a week to compute the tally. So the main proposal of our paper is, can we do this in a concurrent way? So when these P and V values come in, is there some way that we can process it right away on the spot? We don't have to wait or reference any of the other ballots that have come in. So what we propose is that if a P and a V come in and it's a real password, then we keep the vote, an encryption of the vote. This is re-randomized, so you can't link the two. If it comes in with a panic password or a fake password, then we zero it out. So we replace it with the encryption of a zero. The encryption of a vote and an encryption of a zero at the ciphertext level are indistinguishable, so you don't know the result of this. And then, simply, you can use, you know, the standard stuff in the literature for doing a homomorphic tally. Because we've zeroed out all the fake votes, then they don't contribute anything to the final tally. So at a high level, if you think of, you know, you spend a year maybe registering voters, election could be run over a couple days, maybe a week, and in the traditional systems, all the work has to be done at the end. In our system, we're trying to push the workload back in time. So if registration takes a bit longer, that's fine. You can amortize it over the year. And we want to do, as people are voting, we want to do all the work that we can during that process so that when post-election comes, when the last ballot comes in, we can instantly compute a tally or virtually instantly. So now I'm going to talk about how we implement this function. So when you boil this whole problem down, it comes down to sort of a set membership problem. Essentially, you have, you know, the voter comes along with this password, it's encrypted or obfuscated in some sense, and you're just asking, is it on some data structure that corresponds to the registered passwords? And what we really need is, we'd like a function that gives you an encryption of a zero if it's no, an encryption of a one if it is. If we have that, then we can just, you know, take their encrypted vote, we could, for example, multiply it, and the zero would cancel out, so you get a zero, and a one would preserve the vote. Now, I did say this was additively homomorphic, so how you do that multiplication we'll talk about in a second. If you look at the literature, so all the other coercion-resistant voting systems, when it comes down to this fundamental part of it, answering this question, they typically use what's called a plain text equality test. If we expand our search a bit broader and look at, you know, private set intersection literature and literature outside of voting, you see some sort of private polynomial evaluations. These two techniques have basically the same problem. If the answer is yes, that's fine, they give you a unique value. But if the answer is no, they give you some random value across the entire group or the exponent group. And the problem is that we can't take, you know, we don't have sort of tests that say, if something's anything but a particular value, then output a certain message or map it down to a certain message. Okay? So what we propose in this paper is something that will give a function that behaves like the top. And so the mechanism that we propose is a Bloom filter. And in this case, it's going to be an encrypted Bloom filter. So I'm not going to spend too much time on Bloom filters, but basically, it's a bit array. It's of some length n. And if you want to add an element, say a, to it, you map it through a bunch of hash functions. They output an index in the array. And then you set the bit, if it's not already set, to a 1. And then later, if you come along and you want to know whether a is in the Bloom filter after you have a bunch of elements that are added, you just repeat the process. You put a through, and then you make sure that there's a 1 in each particular case. Now, what we're proposing in an encrypted Bloom filter is that each of these entries is encrypted with a public key additively homomorphic scheme. So what happens is A is public. You can put it through the hash function. You can find the right indices, but you don't know what's inside the indices. You don't know whether it's a 1 or a 0 because it's encrypted. But because it's additively homomorphic, what you can do is you can take out all the indices. You can add them up under encryption, and now you're going to get a number that either, if A is a member of the Bloom filter, it's going to be a 3 because there's 3 hash functions, so it will correspond to that parameter. In reality, that's going to be like 80. And if it's a no, then you're going to get some number less than 3. Okay? So we can define a little truth table that says if the number that comes out is a 3, output a 1. If the number that comes out of a 3 is anything less than it, output a 0. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to apply this truth table to that number. So there's a nice protocol in the literature called mix and match. And basically what happens in mix and match is you take your truth and table, sort of like garbled circuits, kind of like a public key version of it. You shuffle the rows of the table using a universally verifiable re-encryption mix network. So you get an output. Now nobody knows which row corresponds to which entry in the truth table. Then you take your value that you want to evaluate, and you just walk through the table. So you say, does it equal the input of the first row? In this case, the answer is no. Does it equal the input of the second? In this case, the answer is yes. And then you output the corresponding ciphertext. So this is how you get a 1 out. Obviously, if A wasn't in the Bloom filter, then you get some number less than 3, like 1, 2, or 0, and you're going to get an output of an encryption of a 0. So this is how you do a sort of oblivious query using a Bloom filter. So how do we take this and build a voting system with it? So I'm, for time's sake, I'm skipping over how registration happens, but I'll say a few words about it. So the first is that voters take their passwords. In this case, it's an obfuscated form, which I'll talk about in a second, and they're added to this master sort of encrypted Bloom filter that the EA maintains. You can see the papers for the details of exactly how it has it, but there's three properties that are sort of important. The first is that the person holding the Bloom filter, they don't know what the obfuscated passwords are. What we're really concerned with is that voters are only adding a single password to it. So they generate a publicly verifiable proof that each voter added just a single entry. No one knows what that entry is. We don't even know if the voters themselves know what the entry is, but they only added a single entry, and that's good enough. And then the third thing is that this protocol also needs to be corrosion resistant if you want the whole system to be corrosion resistant. So that means if someone comes along and says, you know, I want you to go and register this password, or, you know, here's $100 to go and register this password, when the voter walks out of the registration process, they can't prove to the adversary what password they actually registered. Okay, so once you have that, then the voting system is actually fairly simple. So what happens is the voters are going to submit 4 values. The G to the P is the password, and the obfuscation is just a deterministic commitment to the password. They take their vote, they encrypt it in some way that's suitable for homomorphic tallying. They submit that, and then they submit 2 proofs that things are done correctly. The first is that they prove that they actually know the password that's inside of the commitment to the password. What this does is it prevents me from copying someone else's password. So I see it on the bulletin board. If it were just a straight up password, I could copy the value. I could copy the G to the P value, but I'm not going to be able to prove knowledge of the P. The second thing we do is a proof of membership that the vote corresponds to the proper form for an additively homomorphic system. I'm sort of glossing over those details because there's 1,000 papers on different ways of doing that, and our system works with any of them. Also, these two proofs are made simultaneous, so you can't replay the G to the P in the proof and then change the vote and the proof corresponding to the vote. You have to, you know, the only thing you could replay is the entire tuple, which is just not changing the vote, so it's not actually doing anything. Okay, so the first thing that the election officials do is when they receive one of these is they check the two proofs, they make sure they're correct, and that's fine. Then they can use this G to the P value to look for duplicate votes. Because this is a deterministic commitment, the G to the P value will be the same. Okay, so they can ensure that per credential, whether it's real or fake, they can ensure that only one vote comes in per credential. And then obviously if it's fake, we have mechanisms later to filter out the fake ones. Then they can query the Bloom filter using the protocol that I just showed you. And this is going to, if this is a real password, it's going to return an encryption of a 1. And then to do the multiplication, to multiply this 1 by V to preserve the V, they use that exact same mix and match protocol that I showed you. This truth table in this case is much simpler. On input 0, output encryption of 0. On input of an encryption of 1, output an encryption of a vote. So these get re-randomized and shuffled. So the output V is indistinguishable from the input here. If the credential were fake, if it weren't in the Bloom filter, then when we query the Bloom filter, we're going to get an encryption of 0. And then we use the same mix and match. In this case, it's going to output an encryption of 0. That's also indistinguishable from any of the other ones. So there's a few details that I would encourage you to go to the paper to see. The registration process, how to set up the Bloom filter. I'll show you a slide of performance next, but it's expensive. Bloom filters also have a false positive rate, so you have to be a little bit careful about that. There's some optimizations you can do, so you can use fancier encryption schemes to get rid of sets or different steps in the protocol. There's some security analysis that you can do. And we also talk at security analysis that we did do. And then we talk in the paper at a high level about how to sort of do concurrent ballot authorization abstractly enough that, you know, it doesn't depend on Bloom filters, for example. So if there's some other data structure that you want to use, you could probably look at the blueprint and then put that in. So we'd encourage other people may have different approaches that would have better properties or be more efficient. So the last slide is performance. So this is based on number of modular exponentiations. That's not a perfect metric for evaluating performance, but knowing the internals of all these systems, I'd say it's these numbers seem proportionally correct. So there's 4 systems from the literature and then COBRAs on the end. So I'll just walk through the table. So registration, as I said, it's very expensive, as you can see, relative to it. It's because you're doing operations on the entire Bloom filter. That's basically a nutshell. For the voter, to actually cast a ballot, it's very cheap. So it's cheap enough that you can do it from a constrained device, for example, like a smartphone or something. Then we get into processing. So all the systems, they can check the ballot as the votes come in. And then the big step is the ballot authorization. So this is the expensive procedure. So we split it up between the processing that you can do as concurrently as the ballots are coming in, and the processing that you have to wait for the final ballot to come in to do. So you can see, for example, for Civitas, it's very expensive. It's even more expensive than our Bloom filter operations. This is 10,000 voters with 20,000 submitted ballots. And then the big thing is for COBRA, all the work can be done during the election. That's the promise of concurrent ballot authorization, and you don't have to do any work down here. Now, if there were an actual board flooding attack, we'd expect, you know, this 20,000 to increase dramatically. All of these numbers, they're going to grow proportionally, linear for these three and quadratic for the first one in terms of the amount of board flooding that occurs. But for COBRA, it's going to stay at 0. This number will grow. You'll have to do more work during the election, but it doesn't make the difference between, so here, the ballots close, and then this is the amount of work you have to do. It's constant to generate the final tally. Okay, so in conclusion, we've actually seen denial of service in Canada, where I'm from. There was an election to elect the leader of opposition a few months ago, and there was a denial of service on the SkyDo-provided system. Coercion-resistant systems, if you want to attack them at the application layer, you know, they have certain properties that make them a really good target. for doing this kind of denial of service. So it's a tricky issue. But we've shown that, at least in principle, you can concurrently authorize ballots. And this seems to sidestep the issue. And incidentally, our system has the fastest tally out of the ones in the literature. The main drawback of our system, obviously, is the registration step is very expensive. And so we look for future work to try and reduce that. So I'll take any questions. If anyone's watching the video as opposed to in the room, they can ask us questions on Twitter whenever you get around to watching this. Vanessa? So, I'm the middle person, and then those are my co-authors. Yeah.
I have a theory kind of a question.
Yeah.
The question is whether the properties that you want out of the registration process are different from the properties that you would want out of a verifiable vote casting process.
No.
Because they sound really similar.
They actually are essentially the same. And if you look at our registration process, we're just doing a variant on Benlow's challenge. And so, yeah, the registration step is very similar to how you would vote in a traditional coercion resistant. So we have an in-person registration, for example, and there's sort of a cut and choose protocol. Or you could, the other systems use divertible, or they use zero knowledge proofs that are designated verifier, which is also used.
So does that mean that you could use just about any existing verifiable vote casting process to do something similar?
I don't want to say that you can for sure, at a high level, they're very similar, and you should be able to plug in anything to that process. The only difference is, the one difference I might point out is that when you cast a vote, it's usually from a finite set. So it's very easy to do something like, prove that you actually voted for the candidate and then simulate proofs for all the others. If you're registering a password, you can't have these sort of fake proofs or simulated proofs for every other possible password because the space is too large. So that's the main difference. So a lot of the voting protocols, they exploit the fact that it's a small set of possible values that you're encrypting. But other than that, yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry. So that was just using G to the P as opposed to using the password itself. Yeah. We also do some stuff like put it through a key derivation function, but that's just a small detail that's in the paper. Yeah. Thank you.